Once New York was a den of iniquity. It was so bad, even Teddy Roosevelt couldn't clean it up.
Tammany Hall was the Democratic clubhouse that was completely corrupt. And they just figured if the public wants vice, we'll take a kickback and we'll give them vice. And we'll get rich and they'll get their vice. And the city basically functioned that way. And finally, the reformers get to win the election. And Mayor Strong appoints Theodore Roosevelt to be a police commissioner. And then the whole book basically rolls from there.
That's Richard Zacks. Writer's Voice Associate Producer Drew Adamek talks with Zacks about his book, Island of Vice. And is it getting too hot for air conditioning?
It sounds like a crazy question, but we have to think, when is it going to get too hot for air conditioning? Just since the mid-90s, we've doubled our use of electricity for air conditioning of residences, more than doubled it. We use as much air conditioning as the rest of the world put together.
That's Stan Cox. He'll tell us about his book, Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World. First published by the New Press in 2010, it was just reissued in paperback this spring. All that and more coming up on Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt was a force for real progressive change. He broke up the trusts, set aside millions of acres of wilderness for protection, and fought for a fair balance between industry and labor under his Square Deal. But Roosevelt wasn't always so successful. Writer's Voice Associate Producer Drew Adamek interviewed writer Richard Zacks about a little-known period in Roosevelt's life when he went up against entrenched corruption in New York City. Zacks' new book about it is Island of Vice, Theodore Roosevelt's doomed quest to clean up sin-loving New York. It chronicles Roosevelt's time as New York City's police commissioner in 1895 and 96. It follows the bureaucratic battles, lively characters, and astonishing level of vice in 1890s New York. Roosevelt found himself pitted against the entrenched forces of Tammany Hall, beer-loving immigrants, and a police force used to getting its wicked way. Associate producer Drew Adamek interviewed Richard Zacks in May.
Welcome, Richard.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. This story seems to be a little bit of a forgotten instance in Theodore Roosevelt's life. Who was Theodore Roosevelt in 1895?
Well, that's what's so interesting. I mean, I think so many biographers, and they don't mean to, but they kind of get the rose-colored glasses after Roosevelt succeeds so well and is president for 7 years. They just can't help but look back at earlier events and either make them more important or kind of distort his impact. He was a guy holding on by his fingernails in a way. He was coming out of 6 years in the civil service, and he got this amazing appointment as police commissioner, and he brought these Harvard reform Republican values to a city that was completely unprepared for it. It almost is like a dark sitcom sometimes.
And you say that the city is completely unprepared for it. What was the state of New York City? I mean, what was New York City like in the 1890s?
Well, I just find it so fascinating. New York in the 1890s was the nation's, I mean, we forget a lot of things about how important it was then. It was the nation's leading commercial port with 144 piers. It had a population of 2 million. The majority of the voters were foreign-born. It was so international, cosmopolitan. Wall Street dominated finance. Fifth Avenue was the premier address probably in the United States. But beneath all the veneer, the silk top hats and all the rest of it, New York was, well, the title of the book, Island of Vice. It was the place that people came to visit prostitutes, to gamble illegally, to go to clubs that were open all night long. I mean, it really was Sin City, and most of these activities were illegal, and the only reason they were able to happen was because of the corruption in the police department and in Tammany Hall. So Roosevelt comes in and naively thinks he can clean it all up.
There's this idea that this culturally we're sort of going to hell in a handbasket, or things are getting worse culturally. But in reading your book, Island of Vice, some of the things that you describe, the Tenderloin District, for example, are almost shocking to someone 120 years later.
I was amazed. For instance, they had a thing called French circuses back then, which were basically acrobatic sex acts that involved oral sex, hence the word French. But, you know, I can sort of see that. That wouldn't shock a modern audience. But then you have a deposition from Anthony Comstock about women pouring beer on each other's genitals and lapping it off and insertion of cigars and things like this. I mean, this is, you know, 1870s, 80s, 90s. You have nude leapfrog that Reverend Parkhurst witnesses, and and all this activity is illegal. People want to say Las Vegas is Sin City, but, I mean, prostitution is legal in the nearby counties, and gambling is legal throughout the city. These were all illegal activities. And I basically was shocked. I was surprised how far. A party where a 16-year-old girl pops out of a pie. They called it the Pie Girl Dinner. That was 2 weeks into Roosevelt's tenure. He didn't know it occurred, but there were some of the wealthiest men in the city had a dinner, and the moment at the end, after they drank something like 300 bottles of champagne, I forget the exact number, a 16-year-old girl pops out of a pie.
There's this popular image of the 1890s, the 1800s, being a very staid period, but that's not true in New York at this time.
No, it really isn't true. I was just amazed. You know, it's not the kind of thing they could put in guidebooks. I mean, you know, I guess there was a blue book in New Orleans where all the brothels are listed, but you know, New York was also trying to show itself off as the arts capital, and all the paintings that came here, and the Wagner, the opera, and the rest of it. And there was just a demi-monde in New York that was, I mean, 30,000 to 40,000 prostitutes. That's not a small number. Hundreds of brothels. We located 150 brothels in what's now called the Lower East Side, where all the, you know, the Jewish knishes and pickles and pushcarts and all that stuff that's, you know, nostalgically remembered. That was the discount disorderly district of New York in that era. And then at the higher end, the wealthy were having these secret parties with models and actresses, the whole sort of Stanford White affair. It's just, yeah, it's a different city than the Edith Wharton top hats.
That was really an unbelievable scene that you describe. I mean, 300 bottles of champagne.
Yeah, they had a good time. It was the Nikola Tesla, who they refer to as the electrician, was there, and Augustus St. Gaudens, who went by Gus, who was, you know, a famous sculptor, and Stanford White, the famous architect, and the Wall Street guys, of course, were a guy named Henry Poor was bankrolling the thing, but. There were parties. It was kind of an open secret how decadent and debauched New York was, and this is the start of the kind of reform movement that would eventually lead to Prohibition. But Roosevelt's right there on the cutting edge in the beginning here in New York.
So then, give us a sense of who the forces are that are aligned against each other. You have sort of the forces of a wide open city, a corrupt police department, and you have these reformers coming together. How is it that Roosevelt comes to a position of power in this kind of city as a reformer?
Well, it's interesting because I start the book a couple of years, I couldn't resist. I mean, I teased the 1895 when he arrives, but then I jump back to 1892 because that's when a Reverend Parkhurst, Charles Parkhurst gave a sermon in February 1892 that he basically called out all the Tammany Hall guys, all the police corruption, called them rum-besotted, libidinous. I mean, every, you know, $5 word he could think of to identify the corruption in the city. And he expected to be praised to the skies that he was finally had the courage to do it. Instead, the Tammany district attorney brought libel charges against him. And Parkhurst realized that he couldn't necessarily back up all his charges. Everyone knew it. It was an open secret, but he hadn't witnessed it with his own eyes. So he hires a 25-year-old wise guy detective named Charlie Gardner to take him on a sin tour of New York. I mean, if you were a novelist, you couldn't ask for anything better. And Parkhurst and Gardner go out, and the 25-year-old's kind of a gum-snapping type, and he really likes to shock the reverend. And he takes him to a transvestite brothel. He takes him to the French brothels. He gets him to witness the nude leapfrog. And basically, the forces that are arrayed are the reform forces, which I really think Parkhurst kicked off the municipal reform movement in New York in a big way. and Tammany Hall, which was the Democratic clubhouse that was completely corrupt, but they basically had all the votes of the immigrants, so they had a lot of political power. And they just figured if the public wants vice, we'll take a kickback and we'll give them vice, and we'll get rich and they'll get their vice, and the city basically functioned that way. And but the scandals that eventually came from Parkhurst's investigations led to a thing called the Lexow Committee in 1894, and that was so shocking that eventually Tammany Hall was defeated for mayor, and the reformers finally, Tammany won 7 out of the last 9 elections. Finally, Tammany Hall gets to win. Finally, the reformers get to win the election, and Mayor Strong appoints Theodore Roosevelt to be a police commissioner, and then the whole book basically rolls from there.
I'm Drew Adamack, and I'm talking to Richard Zacks about his new book, Island of Vice. Something that I found also shocking is that there are a group of people, in this book in particular, Theodore Roosevelt, who deeply believe in civil service as a foundation of democracy. And it seems so odd now to think of a politician who believes in something almost as mundane as civil service. But he was really a true believer when he came into this.
Oh, he was. He was. And you understand why, because the system up until that point, the Tammany Hall system, was basically, you help me get elected and I will give you a job that you don't even have to work hard. It's just basically going to be a show-up job, or a job that you can kind of, like, for instance, the streets of New York were never clean under Tammany because it was a patronage mill. They just got the votes. The guy who could deliver 30 votes would, you know, get a few appointments that he could make. He'd pass them down to his lieutenants. And the city streets were never cleaned. And Roosevelt just thought that American democracy was really at risk unless we hired capable people to fill the jobs, unless we stopped the cycle of corruption with the political process. I mean, he really passionately believed it. And what's interesting, though, is that he helped institute civil service reform for the police department. And the result was not exactly what he expected, because they came, you know, again, civil service sounds great on paper, but again, you have to create the test that lets the people in. And the first round they did, they had so few, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but very few people passed the physical, and then they didn't pass the written test included math questions that I would have trouble with. I mean, they had so many kind of obscure questions to try and get a smarter police officer. They also included in the first round a test New York geography, like what train would you take to get to the polo grounds? And Roosevelt was hoping to get upstate Republicans who had been better educated, but they kept failing the local geography test. So Roosevelt wound up having to drop the local geography and put in U.S. history. Well, some of the U.S. history questions were incredibly difficult. So you wind up getting these spoofs of the civil service, which one of them that I saw was, if a hen and a half lays an egg and a half in a day and a half, how long will it take 3 police sergeants to catch 3 horse thieves? You know, so the Dems, Does, Ds guys did not like the civil service reforms. And it's unclear whether Roosevelt's, you know, smarter cop was more honest, because a couple of years after he leaves, the whole police force is corrupt again. So that presumably includes the Roosevelt men as well.
So he really tried to institute some big reforms pretty quickly. What did he try to do right away, and particularly things that were unpopular with the general public?
Well, some of the things he did, for instance, he had a honeymoon period of 6 weeks where he was incredibly popular, and he basically announced that corrupt cops would be thrown off the force, and that got a lot of people's attention. He said in the old days they got a slap on the wrist. For instance, if you got caught drinking in your uniform in a saloon, you got a 3-day suspension without pay. Roosevelt said you'd be thrown off the force. I mean, like I said, he introduced the new hiring rules, which unfortunately took almost a year to get in place because of problems. He made vow that there would be fairer elections, and he really delivered on that vow. I mean, this was more in his expertise, and he had the policemen go to 3 days before the elections to the registration date to the lodging houses where there used to be a lot of fake names put down and things like that. And he basically caught them unawares, because if they weren't registered 3 days before, they couldn't say that they had lived there. He wanted the cops to be more polite. He wanted to enforce, and here's where he got a problem. He said he wanted to enforce all the laws and all the police conduct rules. And what people don't realize is we live in a society where we really don't enforce all the law. I mean, everybody drives, you know, they take it for granted, you drive 63 miles an hour where it's 55. Well, Roosevelt really vowed to enforce all, he enforced laws against throwing banana peels in the marketplace. I mean, he wanted to enforce all these laws. And unfortunately for him, 6 weeks into the job, he announced that he would enforce the law against drinking in saloons on Sundays, which was technically illegal. It was a Sabbath blue law. And the only trouble was workers in that era worked 6 days a week, and their one day off was Sunday. And they loved going to the saloon. It was the barkeep's biggest day of the week. And Roosevelt did it for a lot of the right reasons. Cops were taking payoffs to keep the places open. And it was technically illegal, and a secret, you know, a little bit of a covert reason was that was the saloon was the Tammany Hall Clubhouse. It was where they made a lot of their election plans. So if you knock a couple thousand saloons out of business, in theory, you'll hurt Tammany Hall. But the whole thing backfired in a massive way.
I'm speaking with Richard Zacks. How did Roosevelt's plan to enforce the Sunday Blue Laws backfire on him?
I think he honestly thought people would rally to it. I don't think he had any expectation that it would be this unpopular. And basically, city was then predominantly Irish among foreign-born, and the second nationality was German. And both those nationalities really enjoyed their beer, you know, to generalize here, on Sundays. And the Germans actually got 30,000 people marching in the streets before the next election against Roosevelt Sundays. And they were waving banners and singing songs. I mean, he just struck a raw nerve in the city. I mean, no one could believe this. Some saloons had not closed since the Civil War. And here is Roosevelt saying that he's going to, that he's shutting them down. And he's with 1,000 plainclothes cops and the judges, a couple of key judges behind him, he succeeded in doing it. But then you get the November election of 1895. Roosevelt's only been in office like 5 or 6 months. And they overwhelmingly reelected Tammany. I mean, not in the mayor, because the mayor wasn't up, but they elected, you know, all the judges, the assemblymen, the state senators. It was a landslide for Tammany. And that just undermined Roosevelt, because now the Republican Party, his own party, started distancing themselves from him. So he kind of lost his political base, and he became this fanatical reformer who just refused to quit, refused to back down from any of his reforms. So it became a really embattled position.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Drew Adamack, and I'm talking to Richard Zacks, author of Island of Vice, Theodore Roosevelt's Doomed Quest to Clean Up Sin-Loving New York. So this must have been a really formative experience in the political trajectory of Theodore Roosevelt. How did this impact both his political thinking and his political future?
Well, ironically, I think it actually helped him instead of hurt him. I mean, at first glance, you think if a man doesn't succeed in reforming a city that he vows to reform, that's going to hurt him, and if he leaves town and people consider the job. But it didn't really work out that way, mostly because the rest of the country was thrilled to see this man try and clean up New York. He got a huge national reputation out of this, and when he gave speeches in places like Chicago, he just got massive, massive applause. So he never won a popular vote again in New York City itself after this. Three times Tammany was the dominant party, Democrats, but still, three times he didn't win here after being police commissioner. But he learned a lot. He gave several hundred speeches, and a lot of them were, you know, dealing with hecklers, and he honed his speaking. He became a lot less academic and a lot more pit bull like. He became a much more entertaining speaker, much more aggressive, and I think New York gets some credit for that. He saw poverty up close. He took midnight tours on the streets with Jacob Riis. He just, it worked out surprisingly well for him. And then, you know, his political trajectory off that, again, a novelist couldn't make up what happened. I mean, he left New York a little bit with a tail between his legs, becomes Assistant Secretary of Navy through incredible string pulling by Henry Cabot Lodge and some other friends of his. And he, against all their advice, he quits that job a year later to volunteer to fight in Cuba. And they all thought he had just committed political death. He'd never get appointed to a job again. But he's only in battle for 3 days, basically. But he makes that famous charge up the hill with the light blue neckerchief, you know, at his neck and the sniper bullets whizzing around. And he's hailed as a massive war hero off those few days in battle. And the Republicans were having trouble electing a governor in 1898. And they had such a big scandal, and the Republican Party boss, Platt, who did not like Roosevelt at all but realized Roosevelt was electable, basically anointed Roosevelt to run for governor. And he wins as governor, and he so infuriates the Republican Party bosses with his principles and his refusal to hand out patronage that the only way they can get rid of him so he doesn't run for a second term is to get him elected as vice president. And they figure that's a harmless job, and it usually is. Only McKinley's killed 9 months later, and Roosevelt becomes president.
I want to go back to something that you mentioned that I also found inconceivable a modern politician doing, which were his midnight walkabouts looking for corruption. Those are really vivid moments in your book. And what's he up to in those moments?
Well, it's interesting. I think a lot of people have thought that he was trying to chase criminals, or that he was playing, you know, Sherlock Holmes or something like that. But actually what he was doing, Jacob Riis was the famous reporter, photographer who had written How the Other Half Lives. And he was then the crime reporter at the Evening Sun. And he and Roosevelt actually became, he was probably Roosevelt's closest friend in New York at the time. And they even looked a little bit alike, short with mustaches and spectacles. And anyhow, Riis loved to walk the city at night, and Roosevelt wanted to go along. And they take a midnight ramble, and the rule is that Jacob Riis can't write it up. That would somehow be tacky. But he was apparently allowed to tell fellow reporters. So the incident gets written up. Basically what they were doing is looking to see whether police were doing their job. And they couldn't find any police officers. None of them were doing their job. Because policemen in that era, a lot of them found what was called a coop, and they spent the night. They didn't do their job. They were supposed to walk their beats alone. Of course, there were no squad cars or anything like that, so they're supposed to walk alone, and they just didn't do it. So Roosevelt's furious, and then they finally find a cop who's doing his job, they think, but he's talking to a woman, and he keeps talking and talking and talking. Roosevelt's lurking in the shadows with Riis, and finally can't stand it anymore. He comes out, you know, "Officer, is this how you do your duty?" And the officer threatens to beat Roosevelt. He points him to the avenue, and he raises his nightstick. And then Roosevelt introduces himself and tells him that, you know, he should report to headquarters at 9:30 the following morning. And Roosevelt, this thing gets written up, and all the reporters from the other papers just keep embellishing it and making it more dramatic, you know, with the cops, you know, nightstick over Roosevelt's head and the whole thing. And the public loves it. He gets nicknamed Harun el Roosevelt after Harun el Rashid of the 1001 Night. It totally captured the whole nation's imagination, basically, that an aristocratic police commissioner, I mean, Roosevelt was from one of the wealthiest families in New York, would stay up all night and confront these, you know, for a lot of the police officers were large Irish guys who were pretty tough. And the public just loved it. And he started going on these midnight rambles on a pretty regular basis. And that's when he was at the height of his popularity. And that's when he used all that political capital to make the saloon decision.
I'm from Chicago, which has a long and contemporary history of corruption. And there is in some ways this idea of corruption is sport, or corruption is fun, particularly when you wrap it in sex and vice and all of those things. It kind of feels like, hey, let's just let a working man have a good time. But there's really a corrosive effect to democracy in some ways in this. Is that something that Roosevelt identified, or is that something that was a problem in 1890s New York? Was this corrosive effect?
Oh, absolutely. Roosevelt's father had been passed over through sort of a corrupt political deal for an appointment. I think it was one of Roosevelt's almost defining principles that he despised political corruption and patronage and deal making. And he was pretty obsessed with making the police force absolutely squeaky clean. I mean, he claimed that he wanted all the laws enforced. And there were some laws on the books that were, for instance, it was illegal to have a deck of cards in a college. I mean, there were laws like that that the newspapers delighted in bringing up, sort of taunting him with this. I think that, you know, I don't put it this baldly in the book, but I think the biggest lesson I learned from all this is that you can't have either complete corruption, Tammany Hall, where everything is for sale, but you also can't have doctrinaire enforcement of every single law on the books. I mean, the police manual ran something like 150 pages, right down to whether they could carry an umbrella. And I just don't think either method works. You need some kind of common sense in the middle.
I'm talking to author Richard Zacks about his new book, Island of Vice, Theodore Roosevelt's Doomed Quest to Clean Up Sin-Loving New York. The title of the book sort of gives it away, but the bad guys win in the end, don't they?
I know, and I'm so mad about that. It's funny you bring it up. You're in a line there of people who have noted that we're doomed. Theodore Roosevelt's doomed quest to clean up. I fought very hard to not have doomed in there, and I lost the battle. And believe it or not, I'm winning the battle in the paperback. The word doomed will be dropped. Because I don't even think that it's cut and dry that he lost. I mean, given that the arc of his political career, the national reputation, the fact that even that anyone dared try to bring these principles to a city as corrupt as New York is almost a victory in itself. So I really didn't want to have that simplistic message of doomed there, but like I said, I lost.
In the book Island of Vice, Big Bill Devery is one of the characters most associated with police corruption in this story, but he ultimately becomes chief of police after Roosevelt leaves. And for folks who haven't read the book, he's almost a perfect example of corrupt
Tammany
New York
Hall.
Police. Yeah.
Yeah, he would have made it in Chicago. He was quite a character. I have to say I kind of fell in love with Big Bill Devery writing the book. And I wanted to structure the book almost as a sort of Devery versus Roosevelt, but the chronology just didn't let me completely do that. It's an astounding story. Devery is born very poor Irish. His uncle owns a string of saloons. He grows up tough. He's a boxer. He gets indicted 4 times for... He joins the police force and gets caught not shutting down 50 brothels. I mean... Roosevelt said that Devery, represent everything I warred against in Tammany. And you just think, as you read the book, that this man, you know, it's just, when will he be thrown off the force permanently? How many years will he serve in jail? You think that's what you're dealing with. And instead, the man, 13 months after Roosevelt leaves, becomes chief of police in New York in a completely corrupt deal and winds up wealthier than Roosevelt through corrupt dealings with, you know, gamblers and prostitutes and the rest of it. And you just can't, one more thing I'd just like to add about Devery is he winds up having so much money that he and a leading bookie, Frank Farrell, buy a struggling baseball team down in Baltimore in 1903 and bring it up to New York, and they eventually become the New York Yankees. So he was the first co-owner of the New York Yankees and helped design the interlocking NY logo from an old police medal. So it's just, I don't know. Devery triumphs, so does Roosevelt, so I don't know.
Yeah, it really is. There are moments, and I is reading through the book, I thought, there's no way Devery's going to succeed.
There was so much more. There were another 100 pages of Devery. Again, I lost that battle, too, but I just found him fascinating. He eventually runs for mayor, and he's hilarious. I mean, he just was a very funny guy in real life, so, he just winds up telling jokes at every stop, campaign stop, and the media loved him because he was such good copy, but the trouble is he only got something like 1,200 votes, and then he paid so much money, threw so many barbecues and ferry boat rides and the rest of it, but it was entertaining.
So after you finished this book, how did your perceptions and understanding of Theodore Roosevelt change from when you approached the story?
Well, I have to admit, I was a bit of a Roosevelt novice. I had, I won't say night at the museum level knowledge. I mean, I had read Mornings on Horseback and Rise of TR. But I had some of the stereotypical view of Roosevelt. And I just didn't realize, one, how prudish he was. I mean, that becomes a big issue when you're dealing with the most corrupt city in the country. I mean, if you bring someone like that into Vegas now or something, that would be so shocking. And he really was, he believed that men should be virgins on their wedding night. He was very much against the striptease, burlesque type things that were going on, you know, in the city. And that perception of him, and I just also had no idea how uncompromising he was. But on the other hand, I was just staggered by his courage in defying the odds and just standing up. He basically almost stood up to a city. He had a small coterie of elite reformers who supported his views, and so much of the rest of the city was against him, and he never backed down, which is astounding.
Thank you so much for joining us, Richard.
Thanks a lot. It was great.
Yep. For Writer's Voice, I'm Drew Adamack.
Associate producer Drew Adamek interviewed Richard Zacks about Island of Vice, Theodore Roosevelt's doomed quest to clean up sin-loving New York. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. Next up, as the heat waves keep rolling over the U.S., are you cranking up the air conditioning? Well, maybe you shouldn't. We'll find out why when we talk next with Stan Cox about his book, Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World. Stay tuned.
Here's a story about Minnie the Moocher. She was a red hot hoochie coocher. She was the roughest, toughest frail, but Minnie had a heart as big as a whale. A hide, a hide, a hide, a hide.
Hide, a hide, a hide, a hide.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's a vicious cycle. The greenhouse gases we're pumping into the atmosphere are heating up the planet. So we pump more of them into it in the effort to stay cool, cranking up the AC. My guest Dan Cox says it's a luxury we can't afford, and often it's not even good for you. His book, Losing Our Cool, takes a social, political, and scientific look at the conundrum we've put ourselves into with air conditioning and global warming. Ann Cox tells us about some surprising benefits of dialing down the AC or even going without, using older and greener methods of cooling our bodies. Although air conditioning does save lives in heat waves, it could also be making us more sensitive to heat and increasing our rates of infection, allergies, and obesity. Stan Cox is a senior scientist at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, where he spoke to me from on a recent day when the thermometer reached the triple digits. I asked him the usual question I used to get a sound check on the phone before starting an interview. What's the weather like where you are?
Well, it's 107 today, and we've had almost every day since around June 20th, about a month, it's been over 100, and probably half the days, 105 or more.
So have you been losing your cool?
Well, this is unprecedented weather, so you can't really get perfectly comfortable until the temperature drops at night. But you can, for most of the day, it's not too bad if you're in the shade and either a breeze or a fan going. It's only for a couple of hours in the afternoon that the basement is probably the best place to be.
So are you using air conditioning?
No, we have the house that we bought 12 years ago had central air, and we still have it. We run it one day each summer to make sure that it's still in good working order. usually do it when we're having people over to dinner that evening or something.
Okay, well, I'm going to formally welcome you now. Stan Cox, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Great to be with you.
We've just been talking here about your situation. 107 degrees now in Kansas. This is, this is not unusual weather anymore for our country, for many countries. We've been beset by heat waves that are linked at least partially to global warming. And that makes most of us crank up the AC and emit more global warming gases. What's wrong with this picture?
Well, it's a vicious circle that we need to stop somehow. It sounds like a crazy question, but we have to think, when is it going to get too hot for air conditioning? Just since the mid-90s, we've doubled our use of electricity for air conditioning of residences, more than doubled it. And that's even during a time when air conditioning equipment has gotten much more efficient and people have gotten better insulation. But summers are getting hotter. People live in bigger houses now and are using air conditioning a lot more.
So just for the U.S., what's the global warming footprint of air conditioning as we use it now?
Well, as I estimate it, putting various EPA and Energy Department figures together, if you add up the total climate impact of air conditioning, all buildings, residential and commercial, and all personal vehicles, both the emissions that are generated from power plants that are feeding the air conditioners and from leakage of refrigerants from the air conditioning systems, add all that whole climate footprint up, it's approaching a half a billion metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent each year, which, you know, that just sounds like a big number, but it's a very significant contribution to global warming, and it's about half of the contribution to global warming from air conditioning for the whole world. So we use as much air conditioning as the rest of the world put together. Unfortunately, that's going to change. It's already changing very quickly, and the projections are that energy use for air conditioning is going to grow tenfold in the coming decades, with much greater affluence in hot tropical countries. India will probably be the biggest increase, but there will continue to be big increases in use of it in the Persian Gulf area, in Mexico, and China is already going to surpass the United States in its use of air conditioning by about 2020, probably.
And one of the things that you point out in your book, in Losing Our Cool, is that some of these refrigerants are actually very potent, even more potent greenhouse gases than carbon dioxide. Is that right?
Right, yeah, thousands of times as potent. There continues to be some confusion, it seems, when people talk about ozone depletion by refrigerant gases like the old CFCs and Freon, and the global warming impact. So those are two different mechanisms, but most of the refrigerants have either or both of those problems. So after the Montreal Protocol, around the world have been replacing ozone-destroying refrigerants with other ones that are less damaging to the ozone, those other ones are still very potent greenhouse gases. And you know, there's a big treasure hunt going on trying to find the ideal refrigerant that doesn't cause climate change, doesn't affect the ozone, and is also efficient. But so far, we haven't really come up with anything. There are even natural refrigerants. Ironically, carbon dioxide itself can be used as a refrigerant, but it's an inefficient one. And if we did use those types of refrigerants, we'd end up having more emissions because air conditioners would be consuming more electricity to run.
You know, I'm old enough to remember when air conditioning was not so common. And I, in fact, live in a house without air conditioning. And I'm finding it's not as hot as it is in Kansas here on the East Coast. But, you know, I'm finding that fans work pretty well. Talk a little bit about, you know, how it was yesteryear. How did people stay cool?
Yeah, I grew up in Georgia in the late 50s and in the 60s when I was a kid. Well, in 1960, nationwide, only 12% of houses had any kind of air conditioning. And even in the South, only 18% did. And like you say, people used fans. The electric fan becoming sort of a mass-produced item around the 1920s made a huge difference in people's lives. But people would be outdoors more in the shade. You know, often toward the end of the day, the house would be hotter than the outdoors. And because of that, there was a lot more neighborhood socializing that went on. You know, people would go down to the old swimming hole. And I remember when I was a kid, businesses closing for the afternoon in the summer, even factories closing for a couple of weeks when it was really hot.
And houses were also built differently. I mean, I remember the summer of 1988. I lived in one of those ticky-tacky boxes, low ceilings, and I nearly died. That was, at that time, I think the hottest summer ever. I think we probably surpassed it now. Now the house I live in without air conditioning has high ceilings, and, you know, it can stay relatively cool, although the basement is the best place to be sometimes.
Right, yeah. As soon as air conditioning became practical and expensive enough, the construction industry saw that they could actually build houses that could be the same price or even less expensive with air conditioning, because it enabled them to get rid of high ceilings and large eaves and cross ventilation and a lot of features that were necessary without air conditioning. And so we, over a half century, built a whole society, both houses and office buildings, that are now utterly dependent on air conditioning at certain times.
In your book, Stan Cox, In Losing Our Cool, you talk about some of the upsides of air conditioning as well as the downsides. What are some of the upsides of it? What are some of the ways in which it's added to longevity, productivity, and health?
Well, the most obvious positive impact of air conditioning, of course, is that it's been demonstrated that it saves lives and health among vulnerable populations, people who, for reasons of age or health, are more susceptible to heat when we have these vicious heat waves like we've been having. So I certainly wouldn't want to deny air conditioning as a public health measure, or, you know, switch it, turn it off in nursing homes and so forth. But we also have to realize that we've sort of created a situation in which it's more necessary than it would have been. It's interesting that the 1995 heat wave in Chicago that killed as many as 750 people was really terrible, and of course air conditioning was depended on there to preserve health. But there were even more severe heat and longer heat waves that hit Chicago, a couple of them in the 1930s, and there was actually a lower death rate in the city during those heat waves. And researchers who studied this have said it had a lot to do with the state of neighborhoods and people not being afraid of crime, and, you know, sleeping on screen porches or on the roof, and neighbors taking care of each other and so forth. So the degree to which we need air conditioning as a health measure depends on how we build our cities.
You also talk about the downsides of air conditioning just in terms of health. But before we get to that, talk a little bit about how the human body can adapt to, you know, high heat situations. I mean, that was a fascinating part of your book, Stan Cox, In Losing Our Cool, was when you talked about things like heat shock proteins and that the body actually can function better under high heat conditions. Lay that out for us.
You know, researchers have found, and a lot of this has been in, like, sports medicine or in military-oriented research, where they're trying to see how much heat people can take and whether exposure to heat makes us less susceptible to it, and it does. It mainly involves exertion under hot conditions, and these heat shock proteins are in all animals, have them, and they serve a couple of different roles. If you suddenly find yourself in extreme heat, they have a cellular protective mechanism, but they also are, I guess, trainable, I guess you'd say. So if you're more exposed to activity in the heat, the right kind of heat shock proteins build up, and you're not as bothered by the heat. When you are in hot conditions, your circulatory and respiratory systems adapt, and there are other physiological changes that your body makes quickly to protect you. And then the other big adjustment that we make to heat is in our minds, and comfort researchers have found that the range of temperatures that a person feels comfortable in is not a fixed 70 to 78 degree range or something like that, but it changes depending on the temperatures we've been exposed to in previous days and weeks. And obviously, as the outdoor temperature gets warmer, if we're exposed to warmer temperatures, then we find the indoor, warm indoor temperatures more comfortable. But on the other hand, if we live continuously and work in air conditioning and don't have that much exposure to heat, then our temperature range doesn't adjust.
And you say that it can actually be bad for our bodies to go from air-conditioned environments out into the heat and into another air-conditioned, that those kinds of changes are bad for us.
You often hear that from people. It's this sudden change in temperature makes me feel bad, and so there is some research supporting that idea.
You also implicate air conditioning and things like allergies, and of course we also know about more serious diseases like Legionnaire's disease.
So in the case of allergies, that's another case where air conditioning has a kind of a Jekyll and Hyde character, because it certainly is a means of protecting ourselves or our children if we have allergy problems, staying indoors and away from the dust and pollen in hot weather. But if we look deeper and ask why have allergy and asthma rates gone so high in the past couple of decades, one hypothesis among others for explaining this is the so-called hygiene hypothesis, which says that children are not being exposed as much to the outdoor environment, and it seems specifically to soil, and in especially living in cities rather than rural areas, but also in recent decades, just spending more and more time indoors and not out making mud pies in the backyard or climbing trees or whatever. And the mechanisms aren't completely understood, but it has to do with lack of exposure to friendly soil organisms, bacteria, nematodes, and other microorganisms that the body, through our evolution, humans have sort of become dependent on that exposure to help train our immune systems, you might say. And when they don't give that exposure, they tend to go a little crazy. So children may, air conditioning may be both a cause and a treatment for allergies and asthma.
A little bit like global warming, a cause of global warming and a treatment for it.
Right.
So how can we keep cool, or can we keep cool, in a warming world without making the problem worse?
Well, I think we have to start by thinking about not suddenly in the middle of a heat wave saying I'm going to go cold turkey or hot turkey and shut it off, but we could find many, many ways in which we could reduce our dependence on air conditioning, not turning the thermostat from heat to cool on the first warm day in the spring, and then, you know, never opening the windows, trying to take advantage of pleasantly warm weather. And even when the temperature is going to be really hot in the middle of the afternoon, we shouldn't let the forecast scare us. And it says it's going to be 98 degrees or something today. Most of the day, it's not going to be 98, and it's going to be at a temperature at which shade, fan, water, and so forth, all of these factors can make it very pleasant. It's not going to be a world anymore in which I don't think we can get up in the morning, everybody leaves a 3,000 square foot house sitting there empty as they go to work and school, and you've got a big air conditioning unit chilling that whole space with nobody in it all day long.
You also cite a building, I believe it is in India, that uses natural light and all kinds of green, green building techniques. I think that you call it the first LEED certified building outside the U.S., which manages to use far less air conditioning and yet keep people at a comfortable temperature.
Right, and it and other buildings use one of those architectural features you were talking about that have kind of been lost in the age of air conditioning, that they were ironically first developed in the Persian Gulf area, which of course now is most air-conditioned place in the world probably, but they're wind towers that catch the it's a tower, of course, so it stands up much higher than the building and has vents in the top that catch the breezes that go by, and through by funneling that air down through the tower, and sometimes, in the case of this building, wetting the walls of the tower as the air falls through there, its temperature drops dramatically, and it circulates through the building. These were used centuries ago in Arabia and Persia for cooling, and they are not going to produce the kind of cool, still, dry air that air conditioning does, but those kind of technologies can provide comfort, and it will just require that we get away from the kind of industrial definition of comfort and just think about what really does make us comfortable.
Well, it's a fascinating and detailed treatment, a kind of political, economic, and social lens that you train on air conditioning. Stan Cox, your book is Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World and Finding New Ways to Get Through the Summer. I found it a fascinating read, and thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you, Francesca.
Stan Cox works for and writes about the environment, currently at the Land Institute in Kansas. In addition to Losing Our Cool, he's the author of Sick Planet, Corporate Food and Medicine. Next up, Drew Adamick reviews Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk by Ben Fountain.
Accidents happen that take friends' lives. Disease cuts people down. We improve on safety, yeah, we research cures. But there's one thing that we just ignore. Why do we go to war? Why do we go? Why do we go to war?
Billy Lynn's long halftime walk is author Ben Fountain's debut novel, after making a splash with his short story collection, Brief Encounters with Che Guevara. The book is a single day in the lives of Bravo Company, a group of young soldiers filmed by an embedded Fox News crew in a brief yet savage battle in Iraq. The footage of their heroics, broadcast live and in endless loops on the cable networks, turns them into instant national heroes. Bravo Company is pulled from the battlefield and sent on a 2-week victory tour, a stage-managed public relations stunt by the Bush administration to drum up support for the war. The novel takes place on one of the most media-managed events of the year, the annual Thanksgiving Day football game in Dallas. Bravo Company is in Dallas to be the centerpiece props of a live halftime spectacle. Billy Lynn, a 19-year-old soldier from Texas, is the central protagonist. Billy is a lost soul, caught up in the confusing swirl of activity since the battle. He is lonely, comes from a dysfunctional family, and is unsure about his feelings towards the war. Over the course of the day, Bravo Company gets drunk, endures encounters with well-meaning fans, tries to negotiate a movie deal, and prepares to return to Iraq. In that same time, Billy falls in love, struggles with the spiritual consequences of the war and his actions, and confronts the failings of his dysfunctional family. The one failing of this book is the flatness of the characters Bravo Company encounters during the course of the day. While the men themselves of Bravo Company are well-developed characters, the people that they meet run too close to stereotype to have any depth. This flatness of character takes away from the challenging intellectual drama of the novel. Where the book succeeds is in capturing the pervasive garishness and crass, self-serving exploitation of Bush administration propaganda in the early days of the Iraq War. Fountain pays particular attention to the aggressive, macho atmosphere and language of exploitation used then. It's easy to forget how politicized almost every event in American culture was during the Bush administration. But Fountain takes the reader back to that time with a canny ear and a deft use of language that reminds us of how totally the propaganda of war and terrorism took over our culture in the early 2000s. There are very few surprises in the novel. The day unfolds almost exactly as one would expect. However, Fountain adds a plot twist in the latter half of the book that keeps the reader guessing at the outcome. He successfully creates tension and mystery. Will Billy return to Iraq, or will he go AWOL in protest? In the end, Billy Lynn's long halftime walk does what all good novels do. It creates a specific time and place, drawing the audience into that place, and invests us in the outcome. For Writer's Voice, I'm Drew Adamack.
You can read an excerpt from Ben Fountain's book, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox, or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamack is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.